This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. On February 22nd, at a bar in Olathe, Kansas, an Indian man named Srinivas Kuchibhotla was fatally shot. His friend Alok Madasani, also Indian, and another white American man named Ian Griot were both injured. A 51-year-old white man named Adam Purinton, a U.S. Navy veteran, has been taken into custody for the shootings. Witnesses say he shouted, "Get out of my country," to the Indian victims before fleeing. Police arrested Purinton at another bar about 80 miles away, where he allegedly claimed that he shot two Middle Eastern men. Purinton has been charged with premeditated murder and two counts of attempted murder. The Council on American-Islamic Relations are urging authorities to charge him with a hate crime. Meanwhile, family members of Mr. Kuchibhotla are shocked and preparing to transport his remains to India for a funeral. The two survivors of the shooting remain in the hospital recovering from their injuries. My guest is Arun Kundanani. He is a lecturer at New York University and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. Welcome to the program, Arun.
Thank you for having me, Sanam.
So first, from what we know about what happened, just judging by witness statements, does this appear to be a hate crime?
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. The perpetrator talked about saying that they should get out of his country, which obviously has a racial connotation to it. He thought he was attacking people he described as Middle Eastern, which indicates the racial motive as well. So, I mean, I think it's hard to see how this isn't racially motivated.
And we saw these sorts of incidents happening shortly after September 11th, where people perceived to be Muslim or Middle Eastern, who might have actually been Muslim and or Middle Eastern, but not always, were attacked, you know, convenience store owners, or in this particular case, these were two engineers working at a tech company. So do you link what these sorts of incidents to the political landscape in the United States, or are such incidents where South Asians and people who look brown and Muslim are targeted on a relatively consistent basis?
Well, the trend is actually perhaps not what you might expect. So there was an upsurge after 9/11 of these kinds of hate crimes. And then they actually declined quite steadily from the peak after 9/11 until around about 2010. So from 2010, we see a dramatic upsurge again. So that by the time we get to 2011, we're actually looking at numbers that are actually higher than what they were after 9/11, right? So what's going on here is actually not a kind of spontaneous reaction to 9/11, nor actually, I mean, it's too early to say what the effects of the Trump administration will be, but this is not something that has just started since Trump has been in the White House either. And really what is driving this is the political climate, the political rhetoric. And from 2009, 2010 onwards, there have been organized campaigns in the United States, pretty well funded, whose aim has been to portray this idea that Muslims are coming to take over the United States, right? So this is actually a slightly different message from the post 9/11 message, which was about straightforward message about, you know, terrorism, etc. The message since 2010 from the far right activists that are putting this message out is actually more conspiratorial. It's more about the idea that America's about to be put under Sharia law, that the Muslim Brotherhood is secretly infiltrating the State Department. Pure fantasy, but it creates an atmosphere in which anyone who is Muslim or is mistaken for being Muslim, so people who are non-Muslim Arabs or non-Muslim South Asians, are being targeted by figures such as the alleged perpetrator in Kansas. Go ahead.
Does it matter that these two men were neither Muslim nor Middle Eastern?
Well, it doesn't. I think from the point of view of the perpetrator, clearly the perpetrator's I mean, just going on the basis of appearance, and doesn't, and often what you find in these cases is that the stereotype of what a Muslim extremist looks like is actually someone who looks who's wearing a turban, because that's the image that's been circulated in the US media. So in fact, there's some evidence that Sikh men who wear turbans are particularly singled out here. I don't think it, I mean, I think from the point of view of South Asian communities and how we respond to this, I think it's a really counterproductive approach to start saying, well, you know, the perpetrator got the wrong target, as if Muslims in the United States are somehow the right target for this. I mean, I think that the point is that this is racism. Racism doesn't distinguish down to that level. And so, you know, and racism against Muslims is as bad as it would be against Sikhs or Hindus or anyone else who appears to be from the Middle East or from South Asia. So, no, I don't think it matters in that sense.
I mean, if they're going to lump us all together, we might as well work together and express solidarity with one another, which, of course, a lot of South Asian non-Muslims in the United States have done for many years. It's also interesting that the Council on American Islamic Relations has spoken out about this attack on non-Muslims and said it should be prosecuted or charged as a hate crime. Now, a lot of times in such cases, authorities like to err on the side of caution. But at the same time, we do have laws on the books to prosecute hate crimes. How often are those laws actually used?
They're used quite rarely, actually. And we do not have an adequate system in the United States for actually monitoring the extent of racially motivated violence. So, you know, there is no national accurate data on the number of hate crimes taking place. The FBI collects some sort of figures, but it's clearly inadequate, simply from the fact that it's optional for local law enforcement agencies to actually share their data with the FBI. So anyone who's looked at this understands that the official data on hate crimes coming from the federal level is not really an indication of the extent of the problem. And if you have any kind of knowledge of what's going on in local communities around the US, you know that there are huge numbers of hate crimes taking place every day in the United States against Muslims, against black people, against brown people, that just either not reported because the victims have no faith in the authorities to deal with them, or they are reported and not taken seriously by the authorities, or they result in some kind of prosecution, but the racial motive, the hate motive, is downplayed and ignored in the way that the case is talked about and investigated by the authorities. And so we lose that part of the motive.
And of course, it remains to be seen how the federal government will change its own priorities under Trump to prosecute hate crimes. He has made it clear during his campaign and signaled in many ways to right-wing extremists in the United States that he is going to focus much less on them and focus much more on so-called Islamic terrorists and Muslims in the United States.
Right. You know, the problem we're looking at now is that we have a White House that has white supremacists in it. We have a White House that clearly intends to implement a program of banning categories of Muslims from the United States, mass deportation of undocumented migrants from the United States. We're talking about removing millions upon millions of people from this territory. And so that is going to massively ramp up the atmosphere. And as we've seen, whenever policies like that are introduced anywhere in the world, it's not just about what government officials then do and the violence that they inflict, but it's also then the green light that that gives to members of the public to think that their own racist violence will be legitimized.
There's this racial resentment, particularly on the right, against people from minority communities that are seen as successful. Steve Bannon was reported as having said before the election, even before the campaign fully kicked off, that there were too many Asian CEOs in Silicon Valley. He cited some random number, saying that two-thirds or three-quarters of the CEOs in Silicon Valley are from South Asia or Asia. And, you know, in the end, it turned out it was a small minority, less than 19% of managers and under 14% of executives are Asian or Asian American. So the sense of resentment that Asians are taking away the jobs of Americans, how does that play into this story?
I mean, yeah, I think that could well be part of the way in which people like the perpetrator are making sense of the world. But, you know, the point here is that you know, we have had a process of globalization going on now since, you know, at least the 1990s, that has been led by Washington and New York and Wall Street and the various elite institutions that are based in those cities. And they have developed an economic and political model that they've exported around the world that is meant to encourage multinational corporations to invest around the world, move people around the world in their interests. And some Indians have benefited from that, or at least some have engaged with that process and as a result are working here in the US on H-1B visas in various kinds of tech corporations, engineering, etc. So now if the White House wants to roll back that process, you know, that is something for the United States to figure out if it wants to have a different approach. But what is happening here is that people who look different are being scapegoated for the failures of policies that they had nothing to do with. The whole question of outsourcing and so forth, it wasn't that, you know, people from India and China stole anyone's jobs or took away anything from the United States. They were simply trying to operate within the global system that the United States itself has created.
Right. The two Indian men, one of whom didn't survive, were engineers who worked at Garmin, a tech company in Kansas, near Kansas City. And the victim, Mr. Srinivas Kuchi Botla, was in the United States, I understand, since 2003. So he'd lived here a long time. What do you make also of the fact that a white American man, Ian Griot, tried to intervene and, you know, got shot in the hand for it? I thought that was an important gesture of solidarity. We don't often see that. And while the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, is white, so did the person, you know, there was a person who didn't have to intervene, but put himself at risk for doing so.
Right. And I mean, one has to admire his heroism of trying to take on an armed man. You know, we read that he made some kind of calculation that the perpetrator had emptied around of bullets. And so there was a brief moment when there was a possibility for him to intervene, which he chose to do on, you know, in a split second. So clearly this guy's a hero. Clearly, you know, he did not want to see anyone lose their life in this situation, and didn't discriminate between whether the victim was from one background or another. And so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is, you know, something very heroic about the way he acted.
I mean, just as we're seeing the extremist right become emboldened by Trump, it seems as though we are seeing ordinary, well-meaning, compassionate Americans rise up in response, and there are more of them, I hope.
Right. Well, we'll have to see. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, this is a time of political polarization, right? We have a far-right government. And I think we're going to see the biggest mobilization of the left in the United States since the 1970s over the coming years. And this is a conflict that's going to be fought out at all levels of society. It's going to be fought out, you know, in the media, in the political process, but also on the streets. And you know, it is you know, for all the pessimism that we might feel seeing Trump elected and seeing the kind of program he's rolling out, we also have the optimism of the extent of the opposition to it. I mean, I think the one thing we can say for sure is that the center ground of politics has collapsed. The kind of center right and the kind of liberal mainstream no longer compelling to that many people in the United States as much as it used to be. So in that sense, this is a time of, as I say, a time of polarization. We're seeing the same in Europe as well. And it's really up to those of us on the left to understand the nature of the situation we're in. I think understand that really this is a conflict that is fundamental to our very future, and to act with, you know, the same kind of radicalism that the far right claims but can never deliver on.
Right. I'm also wondering if this crime that took place that could actually be charged as a hate crime might also motivate some South Asian supporters of Donald Trump to rethink their support, to realize that they are not immune simply by declaring their support for Trump. They're not immune from the violence of his supporters. I mean, there was a group called Hindus for Trump that was founded before the election. Even in India itself, there were right-wing Hindu fundamentalists that praised Trump, and the Indian Prime Minister, who hails from the fundamentalist parties in India, Narendra Modi, proudly met with Trump. And Trump has also equally been quite excited about reaching out to India diplomatically. But in the end, racists are idiots who don't distinguish between nationalities and religions.
Right,
person is a brown person.
One would hope so, right? One would hope that people would look at this and draw that conclusion. And I think the numbers suggest that there was something like 20% of South Asians in the United States who voted for Trump. Those levels of support would go down. I suspect that the Hindu fundamentalists in the United States are unlikely to do that. I mean, if they were going to do that, I think they would have already abandoned their politics some time ago. They've been supportive of the U.S. war on terror. They've been supportive of Israel. They have no problem endorsing violence against other brown people.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, Arun. And what's the best place for people to read your writings or your work? Your book is still available in bookstores, I assume?
It is. The easiest way to find out about my work is on my website, which is kundanani.org. That's KUNDANANI.org.
We'll post a link to that from our website later today. Thanks so much, Arun.
Thank you.
Arun Kundanani is a lecturer at New York University, and his book is called The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at our website, risingupwithsonali.com, to get daily emails with links to all our stories.